This morning I want to begin with a poem entitled The Land of Beginning Again by Louisa Fletcher. I wish that there were some wonderful place in the land of beginning again, where all our mistakes and all our heartaches and all of our poor, selfish grief could be dropped like a shabby old coat at the door and never be put on again. I wish we could come on it all unaware, like the hunter who finds a lost trail. And I wish that the one whom our blindness had done the greatest injustice of all could be there at the gates like an old friend that waits for the comrade he's gladdest to hail. We would find all the things we intended to do but forgot and remembered too late. Little praises unspoken, little promises broken, and all the thousand and one little duties neglected that might have perfected the day for one less fortunate. It wouldn't be possible not to be kind in the land of beginning again, and the ones we misjudged and the ones whom we grudged their moments of victory here would find in the grasp of our loving hand clasp more than penitent lips could explain. So I wish that there were some wonderful place called the land of beginning again, where all our mistakes and all our heartaches and all of our poor selfish grief could be dropped like a shabby old coat at the door and never put on again. Owning our mistakes. I should begin by saying that this was a fascinating topic to explore and reflect upon. And for the topic and for the book on which most of my reflections this morning will be rooted, a book entitled Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson, I wish to thank Becky Denglinger, who's back here. This was her choice of topic from last year's service auction. The book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, was written by two social psychologists and is full of insights and wisdom into how we human beings function. I will share some of their observations and research and add at the end a spiritual perspective or twist. We are at church after all. When I initially began to read the book and reflect on our human mistake-making capacity, the obvious struck me with new force. Mistakes are an unavoidable part of life. Duh. Whether insignificant or substantial, we will all make mistakes many times, many maddening times over the course of our lifetimes. So the question for us all is not will we make mistakes, but how will we react when we make mistakes? Will we, as my daughter suggests, say, oh well? Will we, as I suggest, say, I'm sorry? with as much sincerity and humility as we can muster? Will we even take it another step and actually learn something from our mistakes? Will we see them as offering us lessons in how to live in ways that are more open-hearted, perhaps more vulnerable, perhaps more accountable? It seems to me we can take two major approaches in life to our mistakes. We can accept them graciously, apologize, accept accountability when we have hurt someone else, and commit ourselves to gleaning as much as we can, to beginning again, that land of beginning again of which the poet writes. Or we can take the other route that the authors of the book so painstakingly detailed for me as I read through it. We can deflect and dodge and blame and avoid the hurt or the challenges that our mistakes have caused. Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me deals with why we often choose that latter course, even though it is the harder path by far. So why do we try to pass our mistakes off on others or disavow that we have committed any mistakes in the first place? Well, the authors begin by talking about this drive that we have, a drive that they say is as strong and as striking as the drive of hunger and thirst, a drive called cognitive dissonance. When we human beings hold two conflicting beliefs in our brain at once, the tension in our body rises, and we seek ways almost desperately and frantically to relieve that tension. This powerful and unconscious motive pushes us to seek alignment, and that dissonance gets stronger if the dissonance is connected to something important, especially something like my sense of myself. For example, if I think of myself as an ethical and loving person, yet when a close friend shares a confidence with me, I then gossip about this person and break the confidence that they have told me, reveal their secret, and then humiliate them in turn. If I do something that doesn't fit with my self-concept, my image of myself, then I will bend over backwards to find a way to see what I have done as consonant with the person I am. I will do something like say, well, she told me not to say it, but really it was in her own best interest for me to share that secret with someone else because more people needed to know. After all, the secret she wanted me to keep was about something that wasn't good for her. It was about how she was drinking too much, so it was really best for me to share it. So see, I am an ethical and loving person because my breaking the confidence was all part of an ethical and loving way of being. Of course, that's a slippery slope, isn't it? The more I bend the truth, the less likely I am to see my mistakes in the first place. My mistakes become something I'm no longer even aware of. I'm creating bigger and bigger blind spots in myself the more I try to create this cognitive consonance. And the chances, of course, of my ever learning from any mistakes, if I don't see them in the first place, also gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. So that's point one that the authors Tavris and Aronson want us to remember. We are very driven by our desire for cognitive consonance, if you will. The second point that the authors make is that our memory also colludes in our efforts to look over our mistakes. We remember things in a way that fits the narrative that we have created for our life. We will actually, it was kind of remarkable, the examples they gave in the book, we will actually conflate multiple situations and experiences in our lives to create a memory that will uphold the story that we want to tell about ourselves. The author talked about how she was so sure that she had learned about this one book. She had read it with her father over and over again when she was a child, and reading this book had been this formative experience that she had shared with her father. Then one day she got a first edition copy of this book, which was so precious and so valuable to her, and she looked at the copyright date of this first edition copy of the book, and she realized that it was published years after her father had passed away. But the story that she had created in her mind about the kind of person her father was, about the types of experiences that she had shared with her father, had become such a commanding narrative in her life, had been such a formative story, that she had made it up. It wasn't even true what she had remembered. Tavris and Aronson suggest that the only way to get closer to the actual truth of our lives, to get out of our own created history, if you will, is to get out of the closed loops that we usually live in, to study the actual events of our lives, and to question our motives. Why do we want the story to be told this way? Why am I so invested in this particular memory? They use some powerful closed loop examples, such as the trend several decades ago of recovered memory therapy. You might remember that all these different people came forward in one time remembering all these memories of abuse and suffering, many of which turned out not to be true. They also say that there's a closed loop, especially in the criminal justice system throughout the world, especially in the United States, where we don't want to even look at the fact that there might be people who were falsely convicted, because then it makes us realize how wrong we have been. In all of these situations, Tavris and Aronson tell us it wasn't until and unless someone or someones removed themselves from the closed loop of people telling them, yes, 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 that's the way it is, yes, I agree, yes, I guess, that they realized that they could see that there were problems, that something was wrong, that the story they were telling over and over again actually wasn't true. The authors wrote about the criminal justice system, for example, but if you refuse to admit to yourself or the world that mistakes do happen, then every wrongfully imprisoned person is a stark, humiliating evidence of how wrong you are. Our errors can become entrenched when we hold fast to them in order to keep dissonance at bay. Which brings me to the final major point that Tavris and Aronson make about why we are so convinced that mistakes may have been made out there in the world, but they weren't by me. And that is the power of self-justification. In a powerful chapter about the ways in which marriages, and I want you to hear the marriages not just as intimate love relationships, but any relationship of significance, can be undermined when people cling to self-justification. The authors said that couples often try to, each one, sort of protect their notion of who they are by clinging to self-justification. In fact, they say these self-justifications break down into two major types. Perhaps you heard my spouse mention these recently in another sermon. One way is the I'm right, you're wrong self-justification. Easy enough to understand. We find ways to confirm that we are right and everyone else is wrong. The second one is, even if I'm wrong, too bad, that's the way I am, which is my personal favorite. I may be wrong, but it's my personality. It's the way I am. It's my way of being in the world. And so I might be wrong, but oh well. That's the way it is. That's me. I'm just being me. You gotta love me, right? So this leads to the crux of what will make or break any marriage or any connection of depth, for that matter. The authors write, and I quote, "They," the couple, the two people involved, "must work to resolve the dissonance between I love this person and this person is doing some things that are driving me crazy." They are going to have to decide how to answer some key questions about those crazy things their partner does. Are they due to an unchangeable personality flaw? Can I live with them? Are they grounds for divorce? Can we find a compromise? Could I, horror of horrors, learn something from my partner? Maybe improve my own way of doing things? I know you're going to throw that one out, right? Self-justification is blocking each partner from asking, could I be wrong? Could I be making a mistake? Could I change? End quote. All of this, of course, requires willingness to look at ourselves and our motivations closely. It might even require us to look more unflinchingly than feels possible sometimes at the ways in which we undermine our capacity to stay in relationship by seeing the other person as wholly at fault for all of our challenges. That's tough. We talk sometimes about looking ourselves in the mirror. The authors want to suggest that not only do you need to look at yourself in the mirror, you might actually have to check in with a few other people occasionally to see if what you think you see is actually accurate. One of the reasons that this is so hard, that this unflinching look at ourselves, this movement beyond self-justification is so difficult, Tavris and Aronson point out, is because we create what they refer to as an implicit theory about our spouse or friend. So let me bring up an example. They're a good person, our spouse or friend, but they aren't very reliable. You know, they're kind of flaky, you know. I mean, I love them and all, but they're kind of flaky. So once we have set our implicit theory about our spouse or friend in motion, then guess what we do next? We reinforce that understanding of that person over and over again with what the authors call confirmation bias. In other words, once I have decided that you are flaky, I find any and every piece of available evidence I can to support my assessment. You are flaky, that's right, showed up 10 minutes late to that thing we were going to do, see, flaky. Anything and everything you do that I could remotely put into the flaky category, I'm going to find it, I'm going to sniff it out like a dog, and I'm going to put it in that category. I'm going to confirm your flakiness. And you know what's wrong with that? It makes it nearly impossible for you to ever be seen as anything other than flaky in my eyes. You can see where this is headed, right? It's a train wreck, right? Here it comes. So I get more and more entrenched in two different ways. I become convinced of my own goodness and blamelessness. I'm not flaky. That's you. That's your problem, right? You're the one who's flaky. Because of all I'm doing to resolve my own feelings of dissonance. I'm this good stand-up person. I'm so great. I'm so wonderful. I'm ethical. I'm loving. And I keep confirming my own sense of my ethical and lovingness. But you're flaky. And I keep confirming your flakiness over and over again. And you see what's about to happen, right? I'm becoming more and more convinced that I am not to blame and never will be. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that you have always been and will forevermore be flaky. And not only are you flaky, and not only is that your fault, but I have pinned you into this theory from which I will never allow you to leave. Gosh, that's unfair. What if you've changed? What if I decided you were flaky because of one thing you did? And then I started constructing this huge narrative about you, and then I can never see past it because I keep confirming it over and over and over again. In summary, we will both make mistakes. You and me. Over and over again, but I will see only your mistakes. And oh yes, I will magnify them. And all the while, I will completely, or mostly, ignore my own. Sounds fair, doesn't it? Yeah, exactly. Oh, baby is with me. I just got an amen. So that's not fair. I'm painting you as this horrible person who will never overcome your errors, and I am not, and I am simultaneously overlooking my own mistakes. So I promised a spiritual conclusion, a spiritual twist on Tavris and Aronson's work. And all of you may wonder, what does this have to do with how we see our spiritual lives? What does it have to do with how we relate to one another in this community? Well, I hope you've already started to see the connections, because it has a tremendous amount to do with how we live in any community, but especially one that is deeply grounded in covenant like we are here. Unlike some other faith traditions, we don't have an ecclesial authority who will tell us when we have strayed, that tells us rules that will and shall hold us together forevermore. We don't even have a doctrine or a dogma to which we all ascribe that governs our congregational life. What we have instead is a shared set of values. Values that center us, values that bring us together, values that hold us to a high calling and a high standard of how we wish to be in the world. We affirm and promote many challenging things, and we will not get anywhere close to reaching any of these goals without making numerous mistakes along the way. So the question is, when I'm trying to affirm and promote your inherent worth and dignity, and I just can't get past your flakiness, I might have to dig a little deeper. I might have to see why I think you're so flaky, and it might have everything to do with me and very little to do with you. I might have to come up with those two words our children were reluctant to find. I might have to say, I'm sorry for painting you into a corner that wasn't fairly or rightly your corner ever to begin with. I might have to say, I'm sorry, but I don't agree And I think you're behaving in a way that is counterproductive. We might have to continue to disagree about some things sometimes. But it is deeply spiritual work to look at our lives, to admit our mistakes, to apologize for them, and then, perhaps hardest of all, to stay afterward. Anyone can make a mistake and leave. That's easy. But make a mistake and then stay. Stay in the relationship so that you continue to be challenged to make new and better and different choices. I've thought a lot about this week about members of my own family with whom I struggle. It's easy to do when you think about people you've been in relationship with over time, people you've been in relationship with over time and wrestled with staying in relationship, those with whom you try to hang in, even and especially when it's hard. Some of you have sometimes asked me about my father because he's the one who never shows up here. Your mom's here all the time. What about this dad of yours? And my father is a challenging person for me. And one of the reasons is because I often see him as a person who doesn't hang in when it's hard. When I was a senior in college, and I'll close the sermon here because you guys are going, yeah, you're prattling on. When I was a senior in college, I got a call from my father, and he told me that he was going to get divorced. And I was so upset because I loved my stepmother and because this was a part of a pattern with my father. My father has been married and divorced 5 times. And I told him that I didn't agree with this decision, that I thought he was copping out, that I thought he was just taking the easy road, that the harder thing, the more admirable thing to do would be to stick it out, to do the work. I went to see some of my professors because I had an appointment after I'd had this heartbreaking conversation with my father, and I went into my professor's office, and we were supposed to be talking about some book of feminist theology, and I was no good for it. I broke into tears. I expressed my disappointment, and one of my professors looked at me, and she said simply and directly and clearly, God love her, Shauna, you have to stop parenting your father. When I picked myself up off of the floor and realized the wisdom of what she had said, I also realized that I owed my father a bit more than judgment. It was easy to judge him, to tell him he was wrong. The harder thing was to figure out how to stick and stay, how to remain in relationship with someone who can be maddening to me, troublesome to me, but without whom I wouldn't exist, without whom I would not love jazz or art or life as much as I do. So friends, I hope that we in this holiday season, when we sometimes are brought into close quarters with those people who challenge us, with those people we have sometimes made mistakes with and who have sometimes made mistakes with us, that we might look again at those connections, that we might be a bit more honest about who we are not, and own our role in those connections. We are not now, nor will we perhaps ever be, the idealized version of ourself that causes so much of our cognitive dissonance. What we are instead is lovable and fragile, vulnerable and tender. What we are instead is human. There is so much more that I will probably say on another day about covenant and its role in our community, but for now, I wish only to emphasize your capacity to forgive and to be forgiven, to begin a new year with new resolve, to not seek perfection or rightness, but rather connection with others that is honest and real. May we hold to that possibility of a land of beginning again this season and every season of life. So may it be, and amen.